My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
You're listening to Studio 22.
Thanks for coming on, boys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having
me. It's my second time.
Oh, you've been on this pod before?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Me and Sean even did like a comic book.
So you're like a reoccurring guest.
Yeah. Have we had anyone else come on twice yet? I don't even think we have yet.
Only reshoots.
Yeah.
Yeah. So hell yeah. Good. Cheers to that.
Cheers. Yeah.
I mean, I hope you guys aren't going to make me talk about comic books.
Only if you want to.
Nah, I mean, I'd be lost in that convo. Yeah. I think I've seen like one Marvel movie.
Only one Marvel
movie? Yeah, I think that, like with my kid or something.
Aquaman?
I never saw any of the Aquaman.
I figured it may be Aquaman.
I got the Aquaman in my house. I have the mannequin Aquaman.
See, that
idea was Aquaman.
Yeah,
It wasn't my idea. I think it was Michael Benson or something, like Abrams Benson, who were writers on the show. And Mike was kind of like the comic book guy or superhero kind of guy. I think it was. I mean, I could be wrong.
I mean, could you have predicted how accurate like that would become in culture? And
Yeah, I think so. Because I think even like the contributions I had for the fake movies would be like, I remember seeing a book about smoke jumpers and being like, yo, that'd be such a cool movie to make, but nobody's going to let me make that movie. So, you know, let's just put it in the show that Vince does smoke jumpers. Like, these are things you go, they're obvious good ideas, right? Like Ferrari, Aquaman, but, you know.
Now you got like Chicago Fire and so many shows and films.
Yeah,
about fire
of course.
Burning,
yeah, of course.
Medellin. So.
Medellin, right? But you go, it's fucking Pablo Escobar, man. Like, who, like.
With Narcos.
I mean, they're good guesses. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I don't, you know. But I think that show was always kind of like, you know, the reason it was zeitgeist, because it existed in that, you know, that ether of reality and a little bit of, you know, exaggeration, hyperbole, but you know, like a surreality.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know, but yeah.
Absolutely.
That's the thing I miss most right now when we're talking about this new show. It's you miss the give and take, right? You create something, you put it out, and you wait to see how it's received, right? And fortunately, with quick response things on social like Twitter and the live tweeting, like I remembered in Ballers, the episode where Kassan T gets shot, that I shot, that I directed, I was like, I can't wait to see people trip out because it's not what you would think would happen.
Yeah.
And ballers. And I'm just like kind of watching Twitter when it ends. People are like, oh, no, you didn't. That's fucked up. You killed my guy. You know what I mean? And you're like, it's so cool, the give and take. So, yeah. And I think that so many, even musicians that I know, and you said you guys are working on a doc, something set in music as well. So it's like, you know, I know having sat with his boy, Rich Barner's friend, Chad, from Nickelback, and I was at the show with them, and Chad was talking about afterwards about, I don't know if it was really expectation, but how he likes the audience to engage in the show, right? And I said to him, I'm like, yeah, man, but it was fucking packed. The place is packed. Not that he was complaining, but I'm like, you had a packed house, right? It's automatically a win.
Right.
He's like, I don't need the fucking money, man. He's like, I sold my catalog. He's like, I'm out here doing this for the energy exchange. Mm. And that vibe, and that, and I kind of feel like, you know, creatively, it's the same way I feel about shit. Well, but I do need the money.
It's a different vibe when you got the crowd. When the crowd sucks, it's a shitty vibe.
Right. He had a great crowd at his show. That crowd was fun as fuck.
When you have a great crowd that's receptive and they're going nuts, it's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah, because you did that for years, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So in my days, it was, if the crowd sucked, or if you were opening up for somebody, they knew nothing about you, especially in Germany, they're like,
oh, yeah.
What is this shit? What is this shit? And they turn their back on you. We want to fight everybody. Yeah, because they don't know you. But then when you break it, they're like going crazy and they love you. They want you to do everything for them. It's just a wild give and take.
And I think from both perspectives, like music, TV, film, it's really cool to hear that like the people making it are doing it, you know, for the reactions, for the culture and all that. And like, you know, a little bit more than the paycheck's nice, obviously, too, but like a little bit more than that.
Well, I don't know how to do anything else. So I've been forced to like, you know, ride with all the ebbs and flows of my career because I really don't have a lot of options.
Was there ever anything that you wanted to pursue, or is it just like, nah, I'm doing fucking TV and film forever?
No, man, I've been doing this since I'm a kid, man. Yeah. I shot, you know, I think I wrote amongst friends, shot it like 23, 24, came out. Like I was a Sundance 25.
Sick.
Hell yeah.
And I've been in the business since. But, you know, a large portion of my 3 decades in this business has, you know, been spent suffering. You know, I don't know if like it's Christ-like, you know what I mean? Levels of suffering. But, you know, in terms of Hollywood standard.
What you love will bring you suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's, but when I say that, obviously I'm exaggerating, but it's, you know, frustration.
Yeah.
Uncertainty, insecurity, your confidence gets fucking knocked down, stress levels are high, you know, your cortisol's out of whack, you know. It's a lot of no's, a lot of no's, a lot of grinding to hear no. So, but with that said, no, I have never really considered doing anything else ever. I've done things supplementally.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, or in addition, like, I had a cigar brand with Davidoff for several years. We always talk about rebooting that. Like, I have interests outside of, you know, outside of film and television. Shit, I'm looking at painting. I love art. There's a lot of different communities I like to, and subcultures I like personally to jump in and out of. And if I could, you know, suck a buck out of one of them, that'd be pretty dope. But so far, it hasn't really happened, so. Am I clinging to that, you know, with hope? But no, this is what I do for better or worse. Whether people hate my shit, let me make shit. It is what it is.
Yeah, I would say that too. With even with acting, I know you know Lorenzo. You did a little acting too. But when you'd make something and your friends are hitting you up and people are saying you're seeing how people receive this, dude, you're like, this is fun, dude. All that time and how exhausted I was making everything, it's like it makes it worth it, even if it's just from a couple friends and family, you know?
It's a good vibe, man. It's a good dopamine fix for yourself. And you know, those milestones are the achievements. And I always tell everybody who's young, and you get on a good run, man, really embrace it, enjoy it, and everything in life, you know? Yeah. No matter what you're doing, because, you know, good runs don't, like, they don't last forever. I remember this fucking guy, this director, he's an old school guy. It's really funny, man. Whenever I talk about the runs like that, I blast this guy. His name is Charles Shire, and he used to be married to Nancy Myers. They made all these big movies when I was a kid, you know, like that Drew Barrymore one where she divorces the parents, and Nancy Myers went on and made like huge movies, and Charles made like a bunch of cool shit himself. But we became friendly through this woman, Colleen Camp. And I mean, this is going back a while. This has got to be a decade ago. And Charles is an interesting cat, man. But he saw I have this Bronco, and he knew I also had like a Range Rover. And he looked at me, and this guy, by the way, this guy's living in like a Beverly Hills mansion, right? And he looks at me, he's like, "You have two cars?" And I go, "Well, yeah, you know." And he goes, "He's like, what are you doing?" He's like, he goes, "This doesn't last forever."
Oh wow!
This doesn't, and that guy just scared the shit out of me. And anytime something starts to go downhill for me, I go, "That fucking guy was right. That motherfucker, man. Like, he just put that shit in my head." But, you know, I'm sure he's still living in his mansion, but he was running Hollywood in a different career, too. I'm sure he does, man. Probably got a chariot.
When you come into this, right. I can just imagine someone going through Beverly Hills on a chariot. It'd be hilarious. But no, man, when I first came in the industry, and I mean, it took a while to get in for me. It took years, you know. But when I did, it was like one thing after another, you know. I was doing things on social media. I was doing a movie. I was doing a TV show. And it was the best feeling in the world. And it did feel like it was just going to keep going. Mm. And then when it slowed down or it stopped, I was like, yo, this sucks. And then you watch your bank account start to go down a little bit. And you're like, where's the next job? What's going on? Like, that lack of consistency for me is something that now that I'm, you know, in my 30s, which, you know, I'm still young, but I have to make a shift, you know, for me. But there is that, like, there's no better thing, I think. Like, there's no job I want more than this, you know?
I don't envy you guys, like, the young guys. You know what I mean? I mean, I envy, like, your skin elasticity. But outside of that, like, I don't envy, like, being 30 in the way with the way that the world is now. You know what I mean? Like, when I was that age, nobody made fucking movies in their 20s. Like, when I came up and made a movie, like, I was a superstar at that time for having just done it, you know? Yeah. It was like nobody could do it. Now, everybody does everything, or they claim to do everything.
And it means nothing.
And it means exactly. It means nothing, man. You know, nothing means nothing, you know? It means something when you're the very best at it, but I feel like the weight of, you know, the gravity of some of these things has been so diluted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you about that, too. You were talking about, you know, making a film at 24, 25. Yeah. I'm like, how'd you put that together? Because that is really impressive.
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime. I didn't even know that till some woman said she wanted to watch it. And I was like, oh, it's hard to find. It's called Amongst Friends. And it was like a big Sundance movie in the early 90s. I was one of the OG, like.
You shot it with film.
Yeah,
it's a different animal than what we got today. It's,
yeah, I would still shoot on film,
rolling the camera and getting takes.
Right? Yeah. They don't even make the cameras anymore. What are you talking about? So, this woman was like, I watched a movie last night. I'm like, oh, how'd you find it? Like with like an old VHS tape or something? She's like, no, it's on Amazon Prime. And I'm like, it is. And then I realized MGM owned it and they sold the library, right? Yeah. So. I'm like sitting in my room and I'm like, what am I going to watch? I'm like, oh, let's put on my movie, right? And I put it on him. I think I had like freshly bathed from my bathtub. I'm in like a fluffy robe. And I put it on and, you know, all of a sudden, like this bong, the guy's like, it's the sound of a guy smoking out of a bong and it says a Rob Weiss film. And my voice comes up and I immediately go, like, like I start to have like a panic attack. Like I don't even know why. Like I should have enjoyed this nice nostalgic moment. And instead, I'm like in slow motion with the remote, like the Matrix, like trying to turn this thing off. But it was a wild experience. The whole thing was just, you know, for, you know, lack of better terminology, it was like a cosmic thing where you go, there's no reason why I should have been able to write that movie, much less direct it, make it, get it financed, get it in Sundance, get it in theaters. And build a life for myself other than, you know, the universe conspiring to get me out of that pl- place I was in my life in Long Island at that time, and now to the West Coast, and then my whole family followed.
Oh, wow.
So basically, it created this migration for all my relatives to move out to California and start the next generation in the Weiss family as LA people, California people. So, and that didn't even dawn on me for like a couple decades, you know. But even the Doug Ellens of the world and all those guys, they were all around for amongst friends. And, you know, I think it was whether or not people actually worked on it. Doug was there for casting sessions. He, you know, he used my office. I had an office at Universal. After the release, he used it to cast his AFI stuff. But, you know, being around it was inspiring to all of us.
Yeah.
To see one of us having made something. Because so many of the people we grew up with said they were going to make things and nobody was making shit.
Yeah.
So it actually helped. It was, you know, like they say, a rising tide raises all boats. It had actually helped the whole crew of us, I think, to some degree. But how it really got done, I don't know. I mean, there's funny stories. Like, I borrowed money. My dad was, like, in the Vegas business. He convinced all these, like, wise guys and gamblers, like, bet on my kid. And guys were like, just $2,500 for you, you know? Hey.
What was the total budget then?
And what I mean, that? I made that movie, like, I only started with, like, $60,000. And I shot some of the best shit up front. And it was like, it was during an IATSE strike in New York. So I was paying some cats cash to like push Dolly, shit like that.
Yeah.
I had an amazing cinematographer who's like become a huge cinematographer, you know, and for the last 30 years. Like he's, but it was his first thing. And he really kind of, you know, I'd been bounced out of film school at Parsons New School. So this guy kind of was like my de facto film studies program, working with him and learning from him. But there was something I was about to say about that. Was there a specific thing you said?
The budget.
So yeah. I started with 60, and we had shot some really great, you know, the most impactful stuff. And then the two producers I had, who were young guys, one was like a Wharton grad, one was a Yale grad. But they'd never worked on anything, but their resume was enough for me because they'd gone to Wharton and Yale, and I was like a fucking moron who'd never really gone to school. So I empowered them, and they ran around the IFC in New York. There was like this big market week, and they got people to come see dailies, and this guy, John Pearson, who was a really celebrated, you know, what is it, producer rep, came and saw it, and he had just gotten $5 million from Island to put in $500,000 and up to like 10 movies. And he just fully funded the rest of my movie and we shot the rest of it. And Sundance, Deauville, Edinburgh, like we went to like major festivals. We were invited to Cannes, but I think the thing with Cannes was that, I think it was gonna be outside of competition in of certain regard or whatever that category is, because we'd already permitted Sundance. I think there was some weird politicking. But yeah, it was hot, man. It was fun, you know?
So you started shooting with only 60 grand of the budget and then actually ended up getting the rest.
Yeah, I started like literally like 40 grand. And I remember like having a full crew and no money to shoot because we had no film. And then my buddy Mike Rapp, who's like a stockbroker in New York, not Rappaport, the actor, he was like, "Hey, bro, didn't you ask me to borrow money for the movie?" And I was like, "Yeah, you got it?" He's like, "Yeah, send somebody right now. I'll give you like 5-10 grand. And I was like, "Fuck yeah, we got film. Let's go." And then like, but it was crazy because it was a real crew, but everybody really like came together for it. That's what was special about it. You know, it wasn't like me. It was everybody, even like the caterers. I remember it was like this couple. I think it was like Norman Marie, and they were like Brits because they'd always make the shepherd pie stuff. But they had their truck. And like they needed to get paid, but like if we didn't have money, they were still cooking. Like people were just committed to it because it was special. It wasn't, you didn't drive around and see people making a movie, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the love of.
And this is 1991. Like it was not like kids were out there making a movie. The person who inspired me to make the movie most was a young filmmaker named Matty Rich, who'd made a movie in New York called Straight Out of Brooklyn. And he had it funded by his church group. And it was like, I think it was like, you know, it was a small indie movie, but it was a feat that he made it. And then at the same time, John Singleton was making Boys in the Hood, which was, you know, really deeply personalized to John's experience. You know, and I remember going to see that while I was shooting Amongst Friends and being like, oh shit, all right, this is what my, you know, my cinematographer was like, we're going to kick their ass. This is going to be great, better, this and that. And I became friendly with John when I got out. And I remember him introducing me to Tyra Banks, like, as my movie is at the end. He's like, yo, this is Rob. He's a new generation filmmaker, just like me. And I remember that's, like, probably one of those moments where I felt like, fuck, I did something. You know what I mean? Because I had such, like, respect for John, you know, having done what he did. Yeah, man, it was wild, man. And you remember, there's no social media.
Yeah.
There's no connection to anything that's basically not 5 feet in front of your face.
Yeah, I like just highlighting that for the audience of, like, you know, putting, you know, writing the script, getting out there and just going and doing it and making it happen. I think that's important for people to hear.
It's just a smaller world, man.
It was fucking final draft. What were you doing writing
the script? So my stepmom had gotten me a word processor and I didn't know how to use the screen. So I just literally used it like a typewriter and I had white out. And I would fix it. That's how fucking, that's how analog this fucking experience was, you know? I was a kid, man. I think I was 22, 23. I started writing it. It was like, I was like, oh, I'm going to make a short film. And I just kept going. And I'm like, well, this is already 35 pages. Oh, I'm already like 50 pages. Holy shit. I got like 140 pages. I mean, it was so fat and epic. It just kept going, you know? Awesome. Yeah. And it was like 12 days. That was it.
It took you 12 days to write it.
Yeah, I think every desperation has always been like a great motivator for me, man. Like, you know, I work best when there's a gun to my head or I just, where I look in the mirror and I just fucking hate myself. You know what I mean? Like where I'm so full of self-loathing that I'm like, I've got to do something. You know, at that time in my life, I was like, you know, like I said, I was early 20s. My friends were all graduating like colleges, you know, they're all... And like, you know, I come from like an affluent-ish area in Long Island. At least at that time I was in that. My first area I grew up in, Baldwin, was a little more working class. But the Five Towns was a little more affluent. And these kids, all my friends, like went away to college, man. They're like at BU, they're at Maryland, they're at American. Like, you know, fucking
you didn't go.
Party schools. Nah, man, because I was like a fuck up. My dad put me through private school. I got out of private school with like a D minus. He's like, I'm not paying you to like fucking go to like fucking Arizona or some shit. Like, fuck, get real, man.
I was a fucking degenerate.
Yeah, it's not. I was a pretty big fuck up, man. So, but he was supportive of me going to an art school because I had talent. I could draw a little bit, paint a little bit, and I could be watched. I could be overseen because it was in Manhattan. So I wound up going to Parsons and, you know, I dropped out to be a club promoter and then I started having meltdowns, like mentally. I mean, like panic attacks. And then I went back to school to get my shit together. And then I got thrown out of school. And then when my friends are getting out of college, you know, and they're like moving into the city, they're going to work at Goldman Sachs, they got these jobs. And I think I was like, probably it's that moment. There's only the first time in life where you look at yourself in the mirror and you go, holy fuck, I'm a loser. Like, and that was probably it for me. No, there's no, I don't believe it's
that's
like,
real, yeah.
I gotta believe that every man, I don't give a fuck who you are, but I do believe that at some point in every man's life, multiple points, you have doubt and you despise you what's looking back at you in the mirror. And I felt like a fucking loser. Yeah. And that's why I sat down and wrote that movie. You know, I was like, I'm not going out like this. And then I went from the ultimate fucking like underachiever to the meteoric overachiever with a 3-picture deal at Universal by the time I'm like 25, 26.
Right.
And all the kids I grew up with are like seeing me when I go home, like, hey, do you remember me? And I'm like, what are you fucking stupid? I went to high school with you 5 years ago. Yeah, I remember you, man.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hysterical, man.
Bob, that's why don't you tell them about the movies you passed on?
Oh, at that period? I don't know. I don't like to think about the no, like, I got really successful, but then I got really scared because I felt like I didn't have a good foundation, and if I didn't write it, I couldn't direct it, I couldn't understand what they wanted. So I passed all, like, Goodwill Hunting, and, like,
oh, wow,
like all these other fucking movies for, like, years. But
that's always crazy hearing that, man. That's like
you just don't know.
Matt Damon, didn't he pass on Avatar? And then he had like an equity deal or something like that where he would have made like $300-$500 million or something like that.
Probably. I mean, it's all crazy. We all do this. Listen, first off, I was in no mindset to make that movie back then. I was being pulled in so many different directions. I had really come from like never having done anything to imagine to pull off this little movie that created some waves within the business. I mean, it didn't make much money at the box office, but it had its fans, and I still hear from people. But when people give me shit over Goodwill Hunting, I go, you understand, if I make Goodwill Hunting, there very well may not be a Ben Affleck and Matt Damon right now. So, like, that's the real reality.
Yeah.
Is I could have tanked that entire fucking film if it went that way. Maybe I would have made something cool. But the truth is, I remember reading the script, not really understanding what they were trying to do because, like, the first 10 pages were in a bar or something. It must have been an early draft. And they had incredible people work with them on that. So, you know. It's a team, man. Team effort, you know?
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, I feel like there's so much content out there right now. Do you feel like somebody today, maybe it does still happen, but can make a film like that, like you made, and go to a Sundance and get notoriety or, you know, kind of...
I do. I think the businesses have changed so much, though, that it doesn't matter. Like, it's like, I don't really, and it could just be because I don't get invited to a lot of places, but I don't feel the sense of community in the entertainment business the way I used to feel this was like a business that people would crack into, right? Because I feel like for film, anybody can make a movie. Like all you need is money, right? Money backs offers. Offers are what gets you talent, that gets you deals foreign, distribute, you know.
You can buy a great script. You can buy a great
Right. Team. You can, like, money generates that. Your two challenges, right, are getting it released by somebody that's reputable or putting it on a platform and getting eyeballs on it, right? And the obvious, making something good, right, that deserves that stuff, right? So that's the only challenge, right? TV is a series of about 7,000 challenges, you know what I mean, to making a TV show. And that feels like the community expanded because now it's, you know, it's being driven by tech, right? The, you know, the streamers change the game. Yeah, it's Netflix, it's Amazon, it's Apple. They have the deepest pockets. But do I think you could still go make a really cool indie that gets eyeballs, it gets people excited about a fresh young voice? 100%, you know? But because there's so much content out there, I don't know how many people see it. Like, but A24,
yeah.
A24 is a perfect example of a company that makes very niche content and they get it out there, man, you know?
Yeah.
You know, things that you would not think that, like, we gotta go mainstream, you know.
A24 is such a real deal studio at this point.
Yeah. They're making great stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you make a movie with $200,000 and make an impact like that? Terrifier, fucking.
What was that?
Yeah. Clown. Yeah.
This clown movie. This guy made 200,000 Jersey dudes. Made like 13, 14 million in the box office, 20 million worldwide.
What was that, a horror movie about
like
a clown?
One of the gnarliest horror films. Like,
really? I gotta get it. I do these little
$200,000.
These little punishment games with my son where we tie him up and put on horror movies of clowns. But he was my son won't walk through the house alone because he saw like some of it.
Oh yeah!
Oh,
so if he was scared of that kid, no. I mean, if he was scared, I go.
It's creepy, dude.
Yo, I watched it when I was like 5, and I remember I went to bed after. It was in the middle of the night, and I had a cousin that's basically like an uncle. He was 10, 20 years older. Fucking goes outside.
Yeah,
I'm like almost
puts
asleep.
Out a mask,
and just screams outside the window.
Yeah.
And like just messed me up for a couple years.
Really, my kid's aunt showed him something. I don't remember what the hell the name was, but the girl's head popped off. And he has never been alone since. And then he won't, like, I'll go in the bathroom, I'll say toilet's down, I'll pick up the lid, and there's like a fucking giant deuce in there. And I go, what the hell is wrong with you? He's like, oh, I forgot to flush. I go, no, you didn't flush intentionally because you're worried the fucking clown's going to come out of the drain. He's like, God, what do you want me to tell you?
Where it comes from.
Yeah, he thinks he lives in the sewers, lives in the drains. I can't get the kid to flush a fucking toilet, you know? He's horrified shit, won't sleep alone in his own bed. But he walks around like he's a G also. That's what's so funny about this kid. He walks around, he's tough. Like, what's up, man?
I love that.
He's only 8, toilet, just dude. For clarity. Oh, he's not, yeah, it'd be sick if I go, oh yeah, he's 27 years old.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we watched like The Exorcist on a sleepover with a couple friends when we were younger too, and that was just like,
yeah.
You know, I love horror.
I don't watch horror films, man.
Oh, I love them.
Yeah, I don't watch too many.
No, I can't, man. I can't do it. Like, I fucking some girl got me high and like maybe watch Midsommar with her. And I was fucking. I thought I was gonna throw up, man. Like, and the crazy.
What the fuck was that? That movie was crazy. That made $50 million.
It was that movie was fucking twisted. Like it was only a
horror movie made in the daytime.
And it was still like nauseating. Something about it.
So creepy.
Yeah, like I remember I put up the poster for it on an Instagram story next day. I'm like, anybody else see this thing? Feel like a little trauma from it?
Right.
And I think it was the most responses I'd ever gotten to a story. Somebody told me they threw up like 30 minutes into the movie. Like, yo, that fucked me up. So like, and then a different girl I'm friends with tried to get me to watch his first film, Hereditary.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. I didn't like the ending.
And then I'm like,
you didn't like that?
The ending.
I didn't get to the ending. So I'm watching it. They're at the party. The sister's having like the allergy attack.
Right.
And I was like, watching it and they start to leave. And I'm like, yo, is this girl going to die? And she's like, do you want me to tell you? I'm like, is the girl going to die? Well, and I'm like, I'm not watching this shit. So I turn it off. I guess her head explodes off of like a telephone pole or something. I didn't watch it. Then she goes, put on the, what's the one with Justin Long where he lives in the basement of a house like that everybody was crazy about, that the Barbarians or something?
Yeah. Barbarian, I think.
So then we watch a half hour of Barbarians. And it starts to get a little creepy, and I go, I'm out, man. I'm fucking out. And I turn that. I can't do this shit, man. It's not my genre.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I grew up with so many of them that, like, as I got older, none of them affected me. And it wasn't until I was, like, I don't know, 28, 29, I was with this chick I was dating, watching at my place, and we put on The Conjuring.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think we're sleeping on the couch tonight because I don't want to walk over to the damn room right now.
Yeah, yeah. Really? It's scary?
That was the only one that got me. Yeah.
The Omen.
The original Omen, man.
Fuck that.
It's all for you, Damien.
Fuck that. Omen is the most scariest shit ever. The fucking VHS popped out at the ending of the movie. It just popped out of the fucking, when I was sitting with my ex-wife, just watching it, it popped out in front of us, and we were just like, I'm not putting that back in. Fuck that. I'm not putting that shit back
in. Dude,
I've never seen the ending.
Actually, when you were watching it.
Watching it, when the demons were fucking all over, that's raping her. Stuff, I was just like, it just popped out. I was like, I'll never watch this.
Yeah, don't touch that.
Burn that shit.
Fucking Exorcist, fuck that.
What was
the ending of,
what was that one? The Hereditary?
Hereditary. I felt like the whole movie was awesome, and then the ending turned into like what Midsommar is.
Mm. Yeah, like the cult.
It was just weird. Like the tent, the fucking tree. I'm like, what is this shit?
Right. Was that his intention? Same director, right? So was he?
Yeah, maybe it was like a little cliffhanger to what the mids that culty thing would turn into. I don't know. Now that it connects, it makes sense.
It was creepy, man. The beginning of the fucking Midsommar with the sister being like, I'm going, I'm leaving, I'm taking mom and dad with me, and they all got like fucking tubes stuck in their fucking
What about
face.
The over the
it's
one
so
woman
sick. Yeah.
In that church went, what the fuck was that?
The old bashing the old people's heads in with the giant mallets. I mean, it's like I don't know. I'm not like really scared of the shit. I'm nauseated by it. I can't explain. Like I get sucked into a movie and I'm just sitting there and I'm like this, and they're fucking manipulating me with a bunch of fucking light and sound and music, and they're pulling me in further and further just so they could go and I go like I just don't need the experience, man. I don't fucking need it. I got enough problems, you know.
You know what was pretty freaky too is the first nun.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Sally Field.
No, the nun.
Oh. Not the flying nun?
No, like the fucking spinoff to The Conjuring.
Oh, there was a spinoff?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think. What was the one with the Australian dudes made?
Babadook?
Is that what it was called?
The Babadook.
Where they had the hand where they like, and it channeled a demon into the body.
Oh, no, that's a newer one.
Yeah. Yo, that movie was dark.
Dude.
That movie was this dude. Takes over the little like brother or whatever, and then just it goes too far. Guy starts smashing his head in the wall, like to the point where it looked like he was obliterated by a gang of 20 dudes or something. It was just insane.
So I just watched one called When Evil Lurks, one of the scariest films I've ever seen, where it's basically a cross between like The Omen, The Exorcist, a lot of possession, a lot of death, a lot of like brutality. It's gnarly.
Well, that's the funny thing, too. Like, I'm a big dude. I don't really get scared of anything. And then when you dive into that realm, it's like, if there's some truth in that, it makes me a little, nothing I can do about that.
It all preys on your subconscious. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's different. Like, bro, like, I'm not scared to walk around fucking LA. You know what I mean? I'm not like walk around like that. You know what I mean? But you put on all these fucking movies and I'm in this security and sanctity of my own home behind gates and locked doors, and I'm still like, you know, it's just a mind fuck. Like that's a skill set, you know.
Like
I wouldn't know how to make one of those movies.
I sleep with the lights on if I watch a horror film. That night I have to. Yeah. Talk to Me is the name of the
Talk to Me. Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we were in my house like a month ago. It was storming outside pretty bad. And my son's with me, and my kid crashes in my room. Like, for a while he was good, and he'd sleep in his room, but like clockwork at 2:33 a.m., Dad?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm scared. Yeah. And I'd be like, all right, man, come on in. And then, you know, there's like a pause where he's probably gauging the escape route, and then the patter of little feet running and diving into my bed. So it just got back to the point where we regressed, and I'm like, bro, it's cool. Just crash out my bed. It's fine.
That's really cute.
I fucking did experience some weird shit in my very house where I was, you know, pretty much raised in. After watching a horror, or whether it was a week after, or whatever I was in bed, and my ex-wife, Jasmine, was she was away. She was in Jersey or she was with her in the Bronx with her mom. She was not home. Some woman is standing in front of my fucking door in my bedroom, taking off her boots and had long black hair, taking off her boots. And I'm just like, yo, it was dark. So it was just a silhouette, but I never forget this. And I was like,
what happened? What happened next?
Nothing happened. Just where'd
it go?
It didn't go nowhere.
No play? No.
That shit was scary.
No, my kid got tripped out. That night wasn't like horror. It was like more like, you know, it was more like training day, right? So it's raining outside. And like, I can't remember if lights were flickering, but something happened and it sounded like somebody was at the gate. Like my home phone rang the intercom and it was like 9:30 at night and all the lights off in the room, get ready, already go to bed. And I'm like, who the fuck's at the gate? Mm. So I pick it up and it's all static, like,
and, that's, like a horror.
And it's like a recording and it's like, yeah, you're lying. You know, it's, busy, blah, blah, whatever the fuck the recording is. So I hang up. My kid's like, who is it? Who is it? I'm like, I don't know. I thought somebody was the gate, but there's somebody at the gate. And then I hear boom, boom, boom on the front door of my house. What? My kid goes, he starts hysterical crying within a tenth of a second. And I'm like, calm down. I go, who is it? And they go, LAPD. And I go, shit. Yo, shut the fuck up. That ain't funny, motherfucker. Right? This is literally, because now I'm thinking like, there's no way it's LAPD. This is some asshole I know thinks is funny or I don't know what the fuck it is. But now I got the kid crying, like squeezing my leg and I'm looking at my lockbox to get my Glock, you know, then I'm going, if it's LAPD, though, I'm going to get shot in the head. Right?
Yeah.
So I grab my phone, my cell phone, and dial 911. I go, hey, like 911, what's your emergency? I go, hey, you know, my kid's crying. I'm like, shut up, shut up. I'm like, I go, listen, there's a couple people at my door who say they're LAPD. Can you confirm that for me? And they're like, what's your address? Like, yeah. So I give the address. She goes, oh, no, those are LAPD. We got a 911 call from your house. I go, I didn't call fucking 911. So now I go to my window and I see the cops like walking around my driveway. They're out in the rain. I go downstairs. Like, I'm in my robe. My kid's in his robe. He's still clinging to me open the door. I'm like, hi, how you doing? And they're like, oh, we got a call. And I look at my kid. I'm like, yo, when I was in the shower, you called 911? He's like, nah, man. And like, but I still, to this day, do not know if I fully believe he didn't do it. And I said, nah, man, we didn't call emergency. And they were like, oh, sometimes when it rains, the lines get crossed, this and that. And I was like, yeah, all right, cool, man, you know? But I didn't know if they were real or fake. But like, that was like real life horror, and the kid was fucking melting down, man. He was like traumatized.
I love how he was within a tenth of a second. Like,
yeah.
After the knock.
Like, yeah, he's just like, ah. Because he saw it on me. I go, who the fuck is that? Like,
that was smart. They're calling the LAPD to confirm. Like, that's
I wasn't presented with a lot of options in that moment. And the camera, out at the time.
Yeah.
The front, because the battery, like, and I just hadn't changed it on that system. I've since gone hardwire, so fuck you, anybody out there getting ideas, but
hardwire is the way to go too.
Yeah,
the safest way.
Yeah. So because they were like, oh, you know, you should fix your camera, and I'm like, oh, thanks, man. You want a water for the road? And they were like, no, we're fine.
Fucking Sebastian Maniscalco talking about it used to be like nice to have the doorbell ring in your house.
Oh, I just saw this.
It's hilarious. It's funny. I'll give it to him. That's funny. You know, it used to be nice to have the doorbell ring.
It's
you
true. Yeah.
Like, hey, who's that?
We got, got company.
Whoa. Who the fuck is that?
Yeah.
And it happened to me the other day. Fucking Instacart rings the bell. And I'm like, yo.
He's like, get down.
It's crazy.
Grandma's crawling across the floor.
Crazy, right? Because back then, I mean, you had a landline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If somebody was in the neighborhood, they stopped by. Oh, I was in your neighborhood. Thought I'd stop by. You know, I bought donuts or that. Like, now it's like you don't want people stopping by.
No. Fuck no. Text me.
That's hilarious. What? So I actually don't even remember this. If I know this, how did you guys meet? How long have you guys been friends? Because I want to get into Mammoth after this.
I think like 2016, maybe. I was before I was 40.
I don't know. It's almost when we were doing Ballers, though, right? Yeah. We had mutual friends. So I think we met
Dominic Lombardozzi.
Is that who it was? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. Because I didn't really know Anthony that well either, that Master Muro, right?
Yeah. And I met you and Nikki at Nice Guy.
Yeah, we had a couple. We had a couple like East Coast cliques that were running around town together. Actually, kind of connected one night.
Oh wow!
So and everybody kind of started hanging out. So yeah, Dom Lombardozzi introduced me and my our friend Nikki C to Lorenzo. Anthony Mastromuro I'd met before, but I didn't really know him. So yeah, we all kind of became friends.
I remember Dom was like, "This is your new crew."
Dom said that. Yeah, funny, yeah, man. He's a cool guy, Dom.
I haven't seen him since that day.
Yeah, that's funny, man.
I've only talked to him on the phone and text with him, but I've never seen him.
I'll ask my Ballers question after if you want to get into Mammoth. If I wasn't sure if you wanted to follow up with that.
I just want to talk about that crazy night at the whatever bar
that was, or whatever. Hysterical.
Snowboard fucking Ragers.
Snowboard Ragers. Like Out Cold, that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were at Mammoth Film Festival, and we were, why were we there? We were just, it was just a place to go that night.
Mammoth or that bar?
The bar, yeah.
No, everything had closed. They had an insane snowstorm, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there were like 20-foot drifts, like pressed everywhere we went. It was like a maze from The Shining or something. And I think the only place that was open was that it's like some kind of tiki bar with snowboarders, right?
It was freezing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and then you and me paid the guy, right,
to
go in. We got all of us in, so we didn't have to wait online, which probably pissed off a couple fucking locals, whatever.
Maybe that's what started it,
you,
right?
You, Peter Fasinelli, Ross.
Yep.
Rob.
I feel like there's a couple more.
Luke.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was probably five or six of us.
The outdoor area, so we were
right,
all
so when we
outdoor,
went in, we went to the outdoor area.
Adam
and that
kid from the gym was there.
Right, but all the, right, so at the outdoor area was mostly the film festival people, right? Yeah, we were all hanging out, smoking, bullshitting. It was cool. It was chill. Inside, like if we're setting, you know, a scene for your audience, I mean, I'd say it was 80% male to female, 20% female, right?
Yeah.
It was very dive bar-ish, and it was fucking packed.
And everybody was happy.
And it was the kind of packed when we walked in there, I was like, oh, this fucking place could be a problem.
I think I literally remember you saying that.
Yeah, like you look around, you go like, listen, if you're in a place like that and you're like 23-year-old like punk ass who's getting fucking tuned up and you're not getting laid at the end of that night, where I come from, at least you're getting in a good fight, right? Like that's just the vibe of it. And we were walking through there, and I was just like, fucking look at these kids. Like, some of these kids were fucking annihilated. So we're outside, and then for whatever reason, the bar people decide they're going to close it. So they're like, all right, let's move us inside. So we go inside. We're hanging out, and, you know, and Brock stands out because he's like a giant. There was one other guy that's like Brock size, but not as wide. And he, like, you know, he just stops, looks at Brock. He's like, oh, you. Looks at Luke. He's like, oh, you guys work out, huh? Like, I work out too, you know? I'm like, all right, bro.
And then there's
this other fucking snowboard type kid in his 20s that thinks he's like, you know, the cool guy at the bar. He's probably, you know, the guy like, oh, there's Jimmy. Jimmy's here, everybody. You know, he's like that guy, you know? And he like comes past Brock and he's like, yo, what's up, man? And you just see Brock just like doesn't raise his hand. The kid just moves along, you know. But we're just like, we're kind of in the middle of the place. At this point, I personally didn't need to be there anymore. I was like kind of over this shit. Lorenzo's like in a fucking, I mean, Lorenzo looks like he's like, you know, coming out of the Ravenite Social Club in New York back in the Gotti era. He's got like, he's got like a cashmere turtleneck, an overcoat, a fucking wool scarf. His hair is like fluffed up. He's just kind of looking around, you know what I mean? Like super fancy. You know, our boy Luke, I'm sure, was like drinking somewhere and chatting to randoms about the wonderful, the wonderful nature of Mammoth Snow versus Big Bear or whatever idle conversation he's making with whoever. I see, and I don't know I think I'm with Brock at this point. And Ross McCall, right? Ross McCall is an actor. He's in Band of Brothers. Really right. Cool guy. Was he British or Scottish?
English.
Yeah,
he's like some, you know, but super dope guy. I guess there were a couple girls who were at the festival. So Ross had been talking to these girls at one of the hotels we were at earlier in the night. So he obviously had some kind of friendship with them. And this kid who's like the Jimmy Cool kid of the dive bar is like grabbing it, like one of the girls. And she's like, dude, back off. And Ross sees this. And immediately he's like, hey, bro, like, chill out, you know? And the kid's like getting a little bit whatever. And I think at this point you walk up, right?
Yeah, I was right there, yeah.
So Brock's like, hey, bro, like, get out of here. And gives the kid a shove, and the kid flies like 5 feet. So the kid comes back again. I don't know how Brock moved back, but the kid comes back again, and like Brock's like, hey, bro, like, get out of here. Pushes the kid again, and the kid goes back. And at some point in this kid's decision, and this kid's not a small kid. The kid's like 6'1". He's obviously athletic.
And this is the kid that was being a little inappropriate
with the girl. He was grabbing the girl. He's just a drunk kid in a dive bar grabbing at this chick.
She was not into it.
Obviously. Yeah. You know what I mean? He's literally grabbing her like, come on. She's like, dude, like, get the fuck off me. And Ross is trying to calm him down. And, you know.
I just made sure I got in between so that there was no way for him to get to the girls. And then he just...
Good.
I had him go
He
back.
Just pushed him out. And Lorenzo was like having conversations, and all of a sudden this kid comes charging at Brock.
Yeah.
Dude, it was like Braveheart, like, or like Last of the Mohicans, where Daniel Day-Lewis has like the fucking thing and he's going to come down on it.
Yeah.
Lorenzo in slow motion sees this kid charging at Brock and is like, hold on. And he goes running in like in some hammer fist. Over the top, boom, onto this kid's face, and this kid goes down. And I'm like, holy fuck. And now the whole bar, like the centrifugal force of it all, just spreads out like somebody had dropped a bomb. And like everybody goes out this way. And I'm like, holy shit, Lorenzo, what the fuck? So I go to grab Lorenzo's arm and pull him back. And I'm not noticing who's next to me. I think we're just pulling Lorenzo out of this fray. And it's the guy who's Brock size who'd been like, hey, I work out too. Yeah. He's got Lorenzo under his neck. So I'm like, shit. Lorenzo, chill out. I'm pulling him. He looks at me like, okay, there's Rob. And then he looks up, he sees this guy, and he does like a double take. Like, why is this guy got his hand around my neck? And Lorenzo punches him with an uppercut. In the face.
The
6 foot five guy goes flying back against the bar. And I'm like, holy shit, this is fucking insanity in there.
And I hit him one more time, and then I'm about to hit him again. He's like,
well, the best is, so now we're like, first off, like, I'm like, all right, this whole bar is going to turn into fucking mayhem in about 2 seconds. Because these cats are like local guys.
Yeah.
What was crazy is the first guy like takes off his shirt and he's like, come on. And I'd never seen this before. And I don't know if it's a result of like the kindness campaigns in the world. But the entire dance floor was looking at that kid like, get the fuck out. Like, and I never saw security. By the way, no security comes. Nobody.
Yeah.
But everybody's like, get the fuck out. Leave. You're ruining the night. And like Journey's playing. Don't stop believing. And people are dancing.
Peter Fastinelli's screaming at me. He's like, Lorenzo, you are a fucking wild animal right now. This isn't Queens. Stop. Look at me right now. You got to calm down. You're a wild animal. And I'm like, I'll kill every fucking body.
It was hysterical. So that kid leaves. Then the 6'7" guy's got like a nice mouse under his eye. He's like walking up and like me and Brock are like back there and Lorenzo's facing us and Lorenzo's like, he's behind me. I'm like, he's lurking. He's trying to figure out if he wants to come over and apologize. Because I don't think that guy was really looking to choke him. I think that guy thought like, let me separate this because these are my friends. Yeah. These are all my friends. I met these guys. Yeah. They trust me. We all know each other.
We all work out.
Yeah, we all work out. And so he started to lurk, and then we're all just kind of looking at him, and then he kind of drifted toward the dance floor. And he stopped and he took one more look at all of us and then he exited all.
I knocked his soul out of him.
Yeah. They were big, bro, they were big shots. They were hysterical. Yeah. The whole thing. Yeah. And the funny thing is I look at Brock and like, he's like, yeah, I love Lorenzo and I don't have the heart to tell him, but I had it under control. I wasn't that worried. He's like, I had it all under control.
Yeah, but I liked it.
The best part about that whole thing, though, is like, I'm watching this guy run at me. Like, I knew because I pushed him back just a little bit the first time. I was being nice, right? I didn't like really shove him too hard. Then he comes at me again, and I'm like, and he's coming towards the chick. Yeah. Like, all right. So I pushed him. He goes back like 10 feet. You know? And that's when he made the decision to charge at me. And I'm telling you, I'm like sitting here, like, kind of smiling, like, what is this guy going to do, really? And I was not worried at all. And I didn't even see Lorenzo come at, and he just came out of nowhere from behind me and just decks this dude.
Yeah.
He folds like a freaking, I can't even explain.
Like just went down, bro.
Like jello.
Like claps. Like
down from like
the, he didn't fall forward. He didn't fall backwards. Yeah, he fell straight down. Yeah.
And just like the way his body moved. I can't explain it, dude.
Like he just got dropped.
Oh my God. Just dropped
straight down.
Video so they can make those new things that they're doing with all the UFC guys that get kicked. They get knocked out and then they're put into a car and they drive off, or they get put into like a horse and they
pierce. Like a gif or like a.
No, there's reels that like they show when the guy gets knocked out and he's about to fall.
Oh,
He gets put into a car and he's like, and he starts to drive knocked out. I was like, yeah, you got to see it to understand what I'm saying. It's hilarious.
No, I've seen those for sure. They're great.
Definitely. Yeah, Mammoth was fun though, man. Yeah, we had a good time. We had some laughs up there.
Yeah. Sounds like that was like a good prevention of things that could have gotten worse, which is good. Right.
That's my line, bro. If you put your hands or if you harm a woman or a child, you're done.
Yeah.
That's my line.
That's where it all started from with the girls.
So what was the transition like going from, you know, massive shows like Entourage, How to Make It in America, and then another huge hit, Ballers? And that, how did you find that transitioning from those shows? Like, was it a fun creative process? Was it like, how did it feel?
You mean from one to the next? Because there's two transitions we could talk about.
Okay.
We could talk about the transition of working for pretty much, let's say, 04 through 15 straight years, basically. A good 15-year run from Entourage, How to Make It in America, to Ballers, to the transition of nothing, right? Which is a very interesting experience. Or we could talk about how to switch gears between projects. I always had multiple projects. So before Ballers, I was writing this Hell's Angel movie about Sonny Barger. Before, I think around the time I had to make it in America, I was still on Entourage when we developed that. But I've been developing a bunch of different stuff, and that just happened to that was the one that was moving forward. So those transitions, I think, are easier because you're in it.
Right.
Steve Levinson created Ballers. You know, he did all, him and Mark did the grime work with that and got Dwayne involved. That was more like I was invited to come on pre-pilot for a writer's room, which was going to be for a few months over a summer to break season one so that if HBO was interested in, I'm not even sure if they'd committed to the pilot at that time, to be honest with you. If they were interested in making the pilot, that they could tell them what season one would look like. Or if they made the pilot, liked it, this we could give them, this is what season one would look like. So maybe that's what the plan was. We'd have to ask Lev. But I went on to it, you know, as Steve's guy with Steve. Evan Riley, who's going to run that show, bought his buddy, Steve, Charlotte. And the four of us got in a room. And we kind of like, in just like a handful of weeks, managed to figure out a whole season of television, right? Which is kind of what we're doing now on the show that we're out with, that people are like, oh, what does the season look like? You kind of got to be fully stacked, you know, in terms of your vision for what it looks like when you go to sell it. Because
even with the pilot, right? Even with just
pilot. I think, like, listen, if they were like, hey, we love it, we'll shoot a pilot. I don't think anybody'd shoot a pilot anymore unless they knew, you know, that you knew what the season was going to be and could walk them through it. Information and the granular nature of it has gotten so paramount for people to fully see the vision and understand it. So at that time, we did that, and then the opportunity just came, like, you know, because I said I'd come on for just these few weeks or months or whatever it was going to be. And then they were like, well, you could stay on, be an EP, do this, do that. And then, you know, the opportunity was good. And I think I had a kid on the way at that time. So I was like, fuck it, let's do it. But that one's more of a Steve thing. Whereas I feel like How to Make It America, I drove that substantially more than I drove Ballers, you know, and in part that was part of my life experience. You know, it was started by Ian, that process, Edelman, on a show he had sold to HBO, but it was slightly different conceptually. So,
see, I think that's interesting to hear too, as like, you know, a fan of all the shows, it's kind of like there's different, even though it's a similar group, it can be different on maybe who brought it or, you know, the writer's room makeup, right? It's pretty interesting to hear.
Well, you know, there's certain things that play to people's strengths, you know. I think that, like, you know, I've never been in a band. Lorenzo has. I don't make music. But I think that people have lanes, but there's something special when certain people work together.
Yeah.
You know, and they click in a certain way, you know. And certainly I felt like we did that on Entourage. You know, I felt like me and Doug knew each other, you know, for a long time. We have a lot of similar tastes and things, you know, or we might find the same things kind of funny. And that might be, to a degree, cultural and environmental, you know, just being a couple like Long Island Jewish kids. Like, there are certain things we're going to share, you know, from the same generation in that area in that time that, you know, we grew up. But I think that, you know, sometimes somebody brings 80 to the table and you bring 20. Sometimes you got the vision, you bring 70, they bring 30. So it's just, it's like, I would imagine it's like a man, you know, with all the dysfunction and all the fucking ego and craziness, you know?
Yeah. Like, you look at the Beatles, it's like Lennon would write a song. And George would write a song. Paul,
they were all talented, man, you know? So the Beatles, you know,
ingredients, man.
Yeah,
you need certain ingredients to make the sauce.
Yep. Well, I appreciate the incredible answer for my shitty question.
It wasn't shitty, you know. And as for the transition of coming out to nothingness, that was a bigger pill for me to swallow. I think, you know, Ballers might not have had the zeitgeist impact that something like Entourage did, but it had a huge fucking audience.
Oh yeah,
for HBO. And I mean, Dwayne at the time also probably one of the top movie stars in the world, you know? And you go, oh shit, like I wrote a large portion of it. I directed a bunch of them, EP'd it. You're like, I felt rewards on being a part of that show that I hadn't felt on Entourage and How to Make It America. And the only reason I could think to justify that feeling is that it was a more complete experience for me, right? Like, I'm writing and I'm directing and producing and I'm doing more things, so I feel more ownership in a finished episode, right? I'm thinking that's what it is. I still don't know for a fact. I love the cast. There's so many things I loved about the experience of working on Ballers. But when Ballers ended, I'm just going to make another show, you know? Because you get fucking spoiled, right? Like, you get like, hey, I go to work. This is what I do, you know? You do what you do. You do what you do. I do what I do. I get to make TV shows. And then like, no, you know, we're going to shut down for this pandemic, you know? And then you come out of the pandemic and then maybe the kind of stuff I do or like to be a part of isn't super popular right now. Maybe there's some other things at work culturally, right? And they don't want to do that kind of stuff. Or maybe they're like, these are the guys who did Entourage. Remember Entourage? What that was? So now you're just sitting there like, holy fuck, like, I just want to go create, man. Like, I want to go work, and I want to make cool shit. And, I guess you do what I did, which was just continue to try to do that. And it's what I'll always do, is just be persistent. But, you know, those transitions to me of not working, coming from work, hey, look, man, I could get a series picked up and then I got to go back to work. That might be the toughest transition of all. I have no idea. I got used to spending 4 hours a day at Equinox, you know? I might be like, you know, like, what do you mean? I don't get to go to Equinox for 4 hours this morning. I got to be on set. Like, that could be a tricky transition too. Hey, I guess like how we navigate life, all these transitions.
But you know what the best part of this whole journey is, whether the ups and downs, the worse downs than there are ups, which makes you appreciate the ups, is I knew Rob maybe 5 months, 4 months, and we're in our steam room in our locker, and the one that we should have talked about. We're executive members at Equinox, so everybody knows that, you know, we have these memberships that we have, like, our laundry done. We have parking. We get free water, coffee, bananas, and apples, and we got lounges. It is what it is. You pay another few hundred dollars, and you get a little bit of luxury.
Bro, I mean, it's a poor man's country club, bro.
It's yeah. Exactly.
He's been around some pretty exotic clubs in his life, but I'm saying it's like ours is literally like the poor man's country club.
So we're in the steam room and we're just fucking kicking ideas around, and he's like, I wrote you into Ballers. I was like, what?
It was actually Lev's idea. It was Lev's like, yo, why don't we use the guys? Put all the boys in.
Oh, so, nice. So I did two episodes because of him and Lev, and, you know, obviously, thank you, Rob. And he introduced me to Dwayne the day that we were doing our scene, and he was like, yo, tell him who your uncle was. And Dwayne was like, who was the uncle? And I was like, Jose Estrada. It's like my family from Puerto Rico. And The Rock went, really? The wrestler? Like, it took him, like, because, you know, he felt it, because my uncle fought with on the road together with Jimmy Fly Snooker, Rock's uncle, Rocky Maivia, his grandpa, and Rocky Johnson. Is that that's the crew in the 70s and 80s.
Whoa, that's such a small world,
it's
right?
It's a very small world. The wrestling community is really tied together. So my Puerto Rican side of my life was they're legends in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Maneco, which is Jose Estrada. He's, you know, they never blew up, but, you know, there's videos of my uncle fighting Hulk Hogan when Hulk Hogan was, you know, about to blow up. That's so and cool. They all came up together. So that was a cool moment. And he did that. And then we introduced Tech Nine, right? Then we introduced Tech Nine to Dwayne. We brought Tech Nine to set. And then they
Hit the hip hop band. Tech Nine, the group.
The rapper. Yeah, the guy, he's a rapper.
I love Tech Nine.
Yeah.
Because Dwayne loved Tech Nine.
I know every Tech Nine song.
Is that the one he did the song with Tech Nine?
Yeah. We knew that Tech Nine was obviously a fan of The Rock. Dwayne always pumped him, like, while he's in the gym, or he's always like, yo, Tech Nine, and, you know, the technicians and whatever. He would always, so we were like, we got to tee this up, me and Shawnee, with Rob. And then they were shooting in, like, Inglewood. And Rob was like, yo, go to set with Tech now. Go to set with Tech.
It's just like, yo, you know Tech Nine? He's like the rapper. I go, yeah. He wants to meet you, man. You want to meet him? He's like, Tech Nine? He's like, yeah. And I was like, oh, all right, yeah, I'll set up. He's like, wait, how do you know Tech Nine? I'm like, I don't know. I know him through people. So that would happen all the fucking time, though. With Dwayne, like, I was out with his stylist, Deloria, like, with some friends or something, and I was like, oh, I was with your stylist, Laria. He's like, how do you know Laria? And I'm like, just through some mutual friends, you know? And then the funniest thing with Dwayne was, like, we were shooting something in Vegas, and my buddy Frankie Cessna's with me on set, and we were just bullshitting with Dwayne about something, and he was like, how do you guys know each other? I said, we met through Nick Diaz. And Frank and Dwayne goes, Nick Diaz, the fighter? I go, yeah. And he goes, you know Nick Diaz, the fighter? And I'm like, yeah, I know Nick and Nate. I go, Nick just left. I put him in the last scene. He was sitting at the poker table. At the blackjack table, he goes, Nick Diaz was here. This is the fucking biggest movie star in the world. I go, you know the Diaz brothers? He's like, no, but he goes, but I love to watch those guys fight. And I was like, well, you just missed him. He just left, man. It was hysterical.
To the point of that, he's one of the biggest stars in the world, and he's the sweetest guy. So
just he's a solid cat, man. Good, good, good guy. Cool.
But I love that, like, intersection of culture, right? Yeah. And, like, your shows were so good at that, of like not only creating an original culture, but also like bringing in the culture, I guess, right, we'd call it.
Right.
That's so cool to hear, because it's like there's a mutual admiration for whatever.
Yeah, I
doing,
think that's
right?
I think it's that's like, really what that's like. You know, what that highlights, right, is that totally. You, Dwayne. I mean, I, you know, I've been around this town 30 years. There's very few people that have the fan base that Dwayne has. I mean, my kid, since he's fucking, I mean, he looks at Brock like he's a god also. He looks hysterical. He looks at Broccoli too and Mammoth like he was a god. Like, you know, like, look at this guy.
Oh, remember that?
Like, he
cool,
played
man.
Hulk Hogan on The Rock Show, because my kid watched The Rock Show. My kid would like trip out about Dwayne. You know, he's like, like, even yesterday he was on his iPad.
Did he ever meet
watching?
Did
he ever... Yeah, he did, but he was like a year old. Yeah. So there's like pictures of like him in my arms on set and Dwayne and my kid being a year pointing at Dwayne, but he doesn't know Dwayne, you know?
That's cool though.
But he knows I knew Dwayne, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, you know, he has a massive, massive fan base, man, you know? He appeals to a lot of different people.
If you look at like Instagram alone, it's like, you know, you kind of got everyone in the mix, and then it's like The Rock, like 400 million.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't know it could go that high.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, he took, you know.
We're close to five.
Now, you think? I feel like the last time I checked,
it's hard to
know.
It's hard to break
let's
it down.
Yeah.
I would say 457.
Okay,
everybody, take a guess. How many of the Rock's followers?
457 million.
That's my
but guess. He only gets 9 comments.
I'll do 420.
I'm joking.
It's 420.
397.
He has 397 million followers.
Like,
that's what? Crazy.
That's more crazy. People than the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, man. Yeah, of course.
The entire United States.
That's a what? I mean, what's the percentage of the world? That's
20%
of the world.
8 billion.
I mean, that's like 10%.
And who's got more? Him, Ronaldo.
Ronaldo's got 700 million, probably.
Yeah.
I'm joking. I'm over excited. Probably got 500.
But that's the point, right? It's like there's like literally a handful of people, maybe.
Yeah.
With that. Yeah. Like a handful.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's so cool.
Yeah. No, it was cool to work with him. And I think as for the culture stuff, you know, it all ties together. My lack of desire to be old and to die to die old. I don't live in fear of death, but like to become old and not know what's going on around me and not have a sense of relevance, you know. And I think all the guys I've always worked with, for their own reasons and in their own ways, have their finger on the pulse, you know, or helping to, you know, push culture in one direction or another, or who have a really great perspective on why there are these cultural shifts and things that are happening. And I think it's important to just be involved in projects that are of the time. You know, like, people bring me really cool shit. And they're like, yeah, it's in the 60s. I'm like, man, you know, I don't want to go there, man. You know what I mean? Like, how is it relevant today in terms of its, you know, the thoughts and the...
Right.
You know
and
what I mean?
Expensive.
Why is it going to...
Right.
Well, yeah, too. But, you know, I think it's... By the way, his cups are fucking dope. Your dad's got a patch in there in the middle of these fucking things. It's pretty cool, man. Yeah, anybody ever steal one of these from a podcast? Like, just walk out with a cup in their pants?
What's up?
Casamigos, how come yours is different?
I don't know. I don't know if they're officially doing something, but we'll be out there. So,
we'll be next door,
dude.
Yeah, we're in like next door to your.
We'll talk offline about that one.
Yeah.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.